Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From not so bad to a whole lot worse than expected, Irene and the damage she did. It's going to be all jobs next week at the White House. And pull up some dust and sit down. Ry Cooter's new album on the broadcast today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by FreshBooks, an online invoicing service for freelancers and small businesses designed to help save time, look professional, and make invoicing easy. More at FreshBooks.com. And by LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It's the 29th of August today. And as we start this last week of the month, you can neatly summarize the Irene news one of two different ways, depending on where you are. Less than expected damage along large portions of the eastern seaboard, North Carolina up to, say, southern Connecticut-ish. Total losses in the Carolinas, for instance, could be less than $200 million. Big sum, in absolute terms, nowhere near what was predicted. And then you get deep into the reaches of New England, Vermont specifically, and people are using phrases like widespread damage and catastrophic. And that's helping push the overall price tag up into the billions of dollars. From Vermont Public Radio and formerly of Marketplace, Jane Lindholm has more.
Rainfall amounts topped 7 inches in some Vermont communities, causing rivers to violently overflow their banks. In the small town of Wilmington, Vermont, bookstore owners Lisa Sullivan and Phil Taylor were preparing for minor flooding when the water started rising.
We went from trying to salvage all the books on the bottom shelf, and once we got to that point, we saw how fast the water was coming up, and then we just had to open up the door to let the water in to equalize the pressure so that the building wouldn't collapse.
Taylor guesses there's more than $200,000 worth of inventory damage and $100,000 worth of damage to the building. He says several businesses are completely decimated. Part of the problem is the way Vermont was developed, in valleys and along rivers. Gregory Sanford is the state archivist.
Rivers, lakes, and ponds were an economic asset, whether it was to drive a mill, be a way to get goods to your place or to a market.
And while those economic benefits served Vermont towns well, they've also made towns vulnerable to flooding, as much of the state discovered today. Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin spent the day in a helicopter surveying the damage.
We obviously have a lot of loss of property and infrastructure, roads, bridges. We have 250 roads in Vermont that are shut down.
Governor Shumlin says it's too soon to assess costs. The state is still in crisis mode. Vermont already experienced severe flooding this spring along many of the same rivers and in Lake Champlain. That flooding cost more than $12 million. Early estimates suggest this event will far exceed those damages. In Colchester, Vermont, I'm Jane Lindholm for Marketplace.
If history's any guide, the Irene news is going to fade from the headlines in a couple of days. Attention will then turn to the next big thing out there. And in the world of economic policy, that's a speech the president's going to give sometime after Labor Day about how to create more jobs. The newest hire at the White House is surely going to have a hand in what goes into that presidential plan. This morning, Princeton University labor economist Ellen Krueger was picked to head the White House Council of Economic Advisors. Marketplace's John Dimsdale has that story.
The Council of Economic Advisers is a think tank of some 24 economists who put together policy recommendations for an audience of one, the president.
I rely on the Council of Economic Advisers to provide unvarnished analysis and recommendations, not based on politics, not based on narrow interests, but based on the best evidence.
Greg Mankiw, who was economic advisor for Republican President George W. Bush, thinks Kruger is the right guy for the job.
He's left of center, but I don't think it's primarily ideologically driven. I think it's primarily data driven.
Kruger is an expert in labor markets, unemployment, and worker training. He recently studied how long-term unemployment saps people's motivation to find a job. Another former presidential economic advisor, Robert Lawrence, says Kruger's expertise will come in handy.
We need to do two things simultaneously, stimulate in the short run, but nonetheless have a policy for reducing both government spending and raising government revenues in the long run. I believe that that's the kind of strategy that someone like Alan Kruger would favor, too.
Kruger is a Princeton University economist who's also spent lots of time in government, says Greg Mankiw.
And he knows Ben Bernanke from the days at Princeton together. So if to the extent that the Fed and the White House have to coordinate, Alan Kruger would be in a perfect position to help facilitate that.
The White House hopes to avoid an ideological confirmation battle since the Senate already approved Kruger once for a slot at the Treasury Department. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Of the many winners on Wall Street today, all right, I spoiled the surprise. It's going to be the happy music when we get there. But of the many winners, insurance and energy were the winningest. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Depending on where you shop or where you go out to eat, you might have noticed a trend of late. More and more packaging labeled as compostable or biodegradable. You can buy compostable plates at Staples, compostable forks at Walmart. They're everywhere. I saw compostable beer cups in Lake Tahoe last week. And it sounds really good, right? You toss it, turns into dirt. Yeah, no. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill reports.
I'm sitting outside in downtown Santa Monica. I have a container full of salad here, and this container is compostable. So my post-lunch activity, find out where to compost it.
Here's the thing. Tossing a compostable container in the trash is pretty much like tossing anything else in the trash. Steve Mojo is the head of the Biodegradable Products Institute, which certifies products as compostable.
Those products will behave much in the same way as most things that wind up in a landfill, which is they're relatively inert, and they'll be there for a long, long period of time.
Compostable dishes are one of those things that it's easy to feel good about buying, but won't make that much of a difference to the environment when you're finished with them unless they are actually composted. And you can't just throw most of these things in your at-home compost pile. Mojo says some thin products like napkins and bags will break down, but
thicker parts such as utensils and things like that may be more problematic.
When a container is labeled compostable, it means compostable in a commercial facility where there's high heat. So I can't toss my salad container in the trash. I can't bring it home. If I want to give myself an environmental pat on the back, I need to find a way to get it to a commercial composter. I take my trash to the man in Santa Monica who knows best, Wes Thompson, the recycling coordinator in the city.
So I have in my bag my lunch container, a compostable lunch container. Where can I take it?
Somewhere.
To you? Could I bring it to your office?
We don't have containers for public use.
And that's the problem with a lot of compostable items these days. In most parts of the country, it's hard to get them to a composting facility, even as the containers, the dishes, the cutlery, and cups become more and more common.
This market globally has been really growing at a very strong and robust growth rate. We see the growth pegged at around 19%.
Shomik Majumdar is a vice president at consulting company Frost & Sullivan. He says globally, the market is over $130 million, driven by people's desire to do right by the environment.
The key drivers that are really boosting this market are obviously the need for eco-friendly products.
Both Majumdar and Mojo point out there is environmental value in some of these products, even if they aren't composted. They're often made from renewable resources instead of petroleum-based products. But without commercial composting, these dishes aren't nearly as good for the environment as they could be. Back in Santa Monica, recycling guru Wes Thompson tells me the city currently has a pilot composting program for 600 residences. The city also picks up food scraps and compostable packaging from local restaurants. He expects the program will expand as demand grows. And then he shows me something else. All right, so now we're outside of your office, and I see what I've been looking for. A food scraps bin.
See, it takes dirty paper, cardboard.
Somebody's coffee cup.
Somebody's coffee cup.
And now my salad container.
And now the salad container.
And with a sense of pride, I send my salad container off to its next life as dirt. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up, oil or your life? A very real question for the Pentagon.
Ways of trying to produce that energy without having to move these massive amounts of fuel.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street rallied today after escaping Irene's path. The Dow Industrials left 254.12%. Close at 11,539. The NASDAQ powered up 82.3%. Finished at 2562. The S&P 500 added 33 points, 2.8%. Ended things at 1,210. Insurance companies, as I said earlier, were the main beneficiaries of investors' relief. The Travelers helped the Dow by surging 5%. Hartford Financial bolted on nearly 13% today. Allstate up 8.5%. Markets moved on some other positive financial news as well. Two big Greek banks announced a merger that gave investors hope about that indebted country. Bank of America bolstered its cash reserves by selling a stake in a Chinese bank, and thus shares of B of A jumped 0.8%. Citigroup deposited nearly 5%. Morgan Stanley and J.P. Morgan Chase each up about 4% on this Monday. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.26%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on mileage and safe driving habits. Learn more at Progressive.com. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The National Clean Energy Summit takes place in Las Vegas. Vice President Joe Biden is scheduled to speak. The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. And author Mary Shelley was born on August 30th, 1797. We have her to thank for the fabulous Frankenstein. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Crude oil closed up almost $2 today, $87 and change at the close. The increase isn't really much on the price per gallon scale that most of us use at the local gas station. But when you buy your petroleum products in bulk, and I'm talking big, big bulk here, literally every penny counts. This summer, the Pentagon's rolling out some ambitious goals to cut its fossil fuel use. For the Navy, a decade from now, the target is that 50% of its energy will come from alternative fuels. Same for the Air Force, 50% for biofuels. So today, from our sustainability desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong starts a three-part series on the American military and its addiction to oil, starting way back when.
It's a long way to Tipperary. Even 100 years ago, in 1911, soldiers and sailors were experiencing the joy of petroleum. Oil historian Dan Yergin won a Pulitzer for his book, The Prize.
It was on the very eve of the First World War when Winston Churchill, head of the British Navy, began the conversion of the Royal Navy from coal to oil, because you would gain greater speed, flexibility.
As war approached, a superior fuel was emerging. The world was going industrial, and so was combat.
It very quickly became motorized, whether you were talking about planes, whether you were talking about this new innovation, which was the tank. All of it depended upon oil.
Dependence. Churchill warned that oil came from faraway Persia, a new supply line to defend. Ultimately, Yergin says the German side ran short and lost.
As one of the great British statesmen said, the Allied cause had floated to victory upon a wave of oil.
World War II, similar storyline.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air. President Roosevelt.
One Japanese admiral said Pearl Harbor was part of a fuel strategy.
To try and get the oil of what is now Indonesia, one of their major strategic objectives. This Japanese admiral said, we have to do this, otherwise we won't have the fuel and our battleships will become like scarecrows.
It was a risky addiction, still is today. But now the Pentagon says it's in rehab because of deadly supply lines in Iraq. Every day, the military hauls in 22 gallons of fuel per soldier, taking on one casualty every 38 convoys. In Afghanistan, one man goes down every 24.
I'm down!
Go around, go around.
I'm taking fire. 10-4, come back.
You may have heard of Preston Wheeler. He drove a military contractor truck in Iraq and filmed this famous ambush in 2005. Three American drivers died.
They just killed him. Oh, Jesus. They just killed him. Oh, my God.
A fellow driver, Robert Rowe, drove 18 missions in Iraq, and every single time, he says, he was attacked, either by shooters or homemade bombs.
They would commandeer sheep and camels and attach explosives to these animals and then herd the animals in front of our vehicles and blow them up.
Convoys stretched 2-3 miles long. Think 12 tanker and container trucks, plus twice as many military escort vehicles. Easy targets. Most of all, Roe remembers when local boys would jump in front of his truck and wave for him to stop.
You stop, you die. And these boys wanted you to stop. That's when your morality comes into play. You don't want to hurt these kids. You're moving your hand, you know, to get out of here. And you just close your eyes and then you hear a thump thump. You run over. Oh, man.
By 2006, one U.S. commander in Iraq had enough. Lieutenant General Richard Zillmer sent Washington an urgent memo. We need alternative energy.
Could you bring some of these off-the-shelf technologies in terms of solar, wind energy, ways of trying to produce that energy without having to move these massive amounts of fuel?
The tipping point was not the cost of fuel, not the environment, but the human toll. And 5 years later, the DOD has new offices and new plans to shrink its energy footprint. Biofuels for fighter jets, hybrid electric warships, solar panels for electricity. Assistant Defense Secretary Sharon Burke says the military knows how to change when necessary.
It's essential that we promote innovation. If you look at the way the military has incorporated nuclear power into some of our naval assets, we needed to be able to go long distances and sometimes to be stealthy and not seen. So we innovated.
Some innovations have benefited the rest of us. GPS, the internet, Teflon. And some think now the military demand could turbocharge the alternative fuels market. Could. So far, the Pentagon has just an energy outline.
It was a very short document, long on bumper stickers, short on substance.
Retired Colonel Dan Nolan says, great idea, but he sees no teeth in the plan so far. And he says, good luck changing military culture, where the energy and logistics guys tend to sit at the kids' table.
In the Air Force, the really cool guys are all the fighter pilots. You know, those are the ones with the swagger. And if you fly a logistics aircraft, you're called a trash hauler.
To go beyond the bumper stickers, the Pentagon has to go into the field and measure its actual fossil fuel use. And it has to change the way it buys things and hang out with innovators. By all accounts, it'll take decades. Retired Commander Richard Zillmer.
Our classic fear is as soon as the price of gasoline drops at the pump, people lose their interest and it falls victim to the next crisis du jour.
For now, though, the military wears a fashionable shade of green as it seeks to undo generations of addiction to oil. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
There's more of our military and energy series, and you can meet some of the characters that we talk to on our website. It's marketplace.org. Guitarist Ry Cooder has collaborated with everybody from the Rolling Stones to Randy Newman and Neil Young. It is, though, his solo work that has mostly defined his career. Albums like Into the Purple Valley from a long time ago and later Chavez Ravine were political as much as musical statements, what he thought about what was happening around us. He has now turned his attention to our current and not-so-great economic situation and how we got here. His new album, which is streaming on our website, marketplace.org, if you want to give it a listen right now, is called Pull Up Some Dust and Sit Down. It comes out tomorrow. Ry Cooder is here today. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Kai.
I was reading some things, obviously, before we sat down, and there's a great quote from you, and it basically says, you know, these times, they call for a different kind of protest song. We're way past Where Have All the Flowers Gone.
Right. Yeah, my mother used to sing that, and I think it comforted her in those days. And I never liked that tune particularly. I thought it was weak. But she was the kind of person who needed a milder kind of a message. These days and times we are in now, I just thought when I was working on this record, I thought I'm going to hit these stories as vividly as I can and try to get the point across in 4 minutes. But you can't just say, you know, chin up, chest out, chain of command anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Here's the first song on the album, cut number one. It's called No Banker Left Behind.
My telephone rang one evening, my buddy called for me, said the bankers all are leaving, you better come round and see. It's starting revelation, they robbed the nation blind, they're all down at the station, no banker left behind. No banker, no banker, no banker could I find.
In the 30s, we had our depression then, and so in those times, it was... We think of it as where populist music really arose. And this was the kind of song that people like Uncle Dave Macon with his banjo would write. Direct experience. I went down to the bank today and I couldn't get my money. So what did I do? I went home with my banjo or my mandolin, guitar perhaps, and wrote a song. Like Woody with his Dust Bowl ballads.
Woody Guthrie.
I mean, the 14th day of April of 1935, there struck the worst of dust storms. He saw it. Here it came, you know, an incredible experience, a 1,000-foot-high dust cloud. Tear your face off. Yeah. Kill everything.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, you're talking about the Depression and Dust Bowl and Woody Guthrie saw it. It's amazing to remember that 3 years ago, there were people lined up outside banks waiting to get their money out because they didn't think it was going to be there in the morning.
That's exactly the point. Here we have these same experiences people are having and going to have, only it's worse now.
Yeah.
More loss of investor money, home values. These kind of songs can say these things. You can say a lot in 4 minutes, you know, if you get your metaphor straight.
Do people think about this kind of stuff differently when they hear it in a song? Is it a four-minute song versus a four-minute news story?
I just think that they do, and it comes into the brain in a different way. And if you ever saw Pete Seeger do this thing of his where he would stand in a room, it could be 10 people, 100 people, 1,000 people or more, and here's a song, and he would present it, and within minutes, he'd get everybody to sing. Feeling solidarity and kinship with the person sitting next to them. I've seen this so many times. This is what a song can do that I don't know if a news story can be absorbed in that way, or even when I listen to these political programs, say, on the radio, and I know and I'm listening and I'm concentrating and trying to get the facts straight, but the song can bypass all that, you know.
Was there a moment in the last 3 years? I mean, what was the moment when you said, you know what, I got to write this down and put this to music?
Well, No Banker Left Behind originated with a line from Robert Shear's Truth Dig blog.
Mm.
And I read this pretty regularly. And when I saw this, it's metric, I thought, No Banker Left Behind. So that tune came to me pretty quickly. Yeah, that was about 2 hours worth of work, I guess.
Really?
Well, sure, because how would it go? It would go in this time frame, a kind of clog dance beat, would have a mandolin and a banjo, which this does, and then you have to make it visual if you can. The conductor's saying, come on, we're getting aboard, we got champagne here. adios, we wave goodbye to the train.
You know, it's so interesting you went to the instruments and the kind of music it is, because one thing that comes through as you listen through this disc is the number of different kinds of music you have. You got jug band, you got blues in there. Here's one, it's called John Lee Hooker for President, which I really like.
Mm-hmm. When I first came to town, people, I was walking down Pennsylvania Avenue, and I heard a lot of people talking about the White House.
So that's just straight out good old time blues. I mean, I love that one.
Well, to me, these musical styles and sounds are narratives as well. I mean, everything about them, if it's an accordion, horns, the banda horns for the immigrant tunes,
yeah,
they all are part of the story. And you can see it then. You can imagine the Arizona border that's hot, 120 degrees in the shade, dusty. Banda horns are coming from some truck over there.
This is the Corrida of Jesse Jam.
Boys, I was branded as a bandit and bank robber, but I never turned a family from their home. I was sworn to pass no judgments here in heaven, but there's goings on a man can't stand no more.
Here's the thing, though, that hit me when I was listening to this and thinking about talking to you. The point of protest songs, right, the reason you write them is to change things, right?
Hopefully, yeah.
Well, do you really think you're going to change things?
What I like the idea of in these songs is if you follow the logic of each tune, this happened and this happened, and you can see that at the end, this is the result. You just didn't see it this way before. You never thought of Wall Street in terms of Jesse James and bilingual heaven. Little song has another idea for you, another perspective for you, see. So that's my hope. But I do this for myself, first of all, because I like to do it. I feel better. I'm not so frustrated, and I can write these things down. Mm. What will the public think? I have no idea. I used to have radio for these things and used to have record stores, for heaven's sake. But I'm 64 this year, so I can't worry about that.
The latest record from Ry Cooder is called Pull Up Some Dust and Sit Down. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation, supporting customer choice and clean, efficient energy sources and technologies, working with customers nationwide to create a sustainable energy future. Constellation.com. And by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of Cynical Advertising, courtesy of Ad Age magazine. All you dads out there who like to sneak your kids sugary cereal when you think nobody's looking, Kellogg's has something for you. The company is launching a new TV campaign aimed at the half of men, 50% of men, aged 16 to 64, who say they buy most of the family groceries in their household. Frosted Flakes ads, airing only in primetime, including, as it happens, on ESPN. Kellogg said the time slots and the campaign itself have nothing at all to do with new regulations about how foods are marketed to kids. Nothing at all was the quote there. I was going to do a real big, they're great right here, but people told me not to. They said it'd sound stupid, so I'm not going to.
They're great!
I'm going to let him do it instead. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media on this Tuesday. No, it's Monday, actually. Today, the Dow up 254 points. I've been away. Come on, give me a break. 2.25%. The NASDAQ powered up 82 points, 3.33%. The S&P 500 added 33 points, 2.8%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow for the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in the breakdown. That's our look at what's happening in the economy one step at a time. Coming up next time back here in our military series, it's Green Marines.
We just set the solar charger out and just set the batteries in there every time we needed to and just rotated batteries out.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. I do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.